This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I spent most of last week in bed with the flu, waiting for my voice to return. It's good to be back, and if you're at home with the flu today, I hope you feel better soon. Well, President Bush has just been briefed by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell on the best timing for a ground war in the Gulf, and it appears ground fighting is still a couple of weeks away. Our first guest today, Admiral Eugene Carroll, says that if and when ground fighting does get started, it's likely to change our impressions about the war. Carroll was a naval aviator during the Korean War. He commanded the aircraft carrier the USS Midway during Vietnam, and he was the first naval officer to direct military operations for all U.S. forces in Europe and in the Middle East. Now retired from the military, Carroll is the deputy director of the Center for Defense Information. He spoke with producer Pat Ford.
What do you think the Cheney-Powell trip to Saudi Arabia accomplished? What was on their mind when they went over there?
They went to receive firsthand, face-to-face information and advice from General Schwarzkopf and his senior staff as to the state of readiness of our forces to move into a ground war. They got that impression in a very short time. 48 hours doesn't enable you to evaluate the state of readiness of a half a million men and women under arms, but I'm sure they feel more current and more confident in their appraisal of the situation today.
And what do you think they're telling the president, and what should he be asking them?
Two factors here. One is purely military, and I hope that Secretary Cheney and General Powell are advising solely with reference to the military factors. That could be two-pronged. One, we can use more time to increase the readiness of some of the people who recently arrived in the theater and get the equipment that just arrived a week or so ago moved forward and ready for combat. Two, we've got to look ahead at the weather pattern and recognize the longer we wait, the more we're going to be concerned about combat dragging on into the summer period. And I'm sure that from a military standpoint, General Schwarzkopf doesn't want his troops fighting out there in 130-degree temperatures.
What could more bombing accomplish at this point, since there's already been such extensive bombing?
Well, that's another element of the military equation. If the bombing is continuing to inflict substantial damage on the forces, on Iraqi forces, cutting into their supplies, cutting into their equipment, then you reduce the amount of resistance that you may encounter once the land war phase starts. In other words, you take away tanks and artillery, you take away supplies, and that weakens the ability of the Iraqi forces to defend against our attack.
But it seems that for so many bombing sorties over the past few weeks, really relatively little damage has been done, given the power that's been unleashed on the countries.
I believe the perception that the war was going very, very well in the air was heightened and perhaps even fostered as a deliberate policy of the administration to convince the American public that we're really doing well. It's a clean war, a sanitary war, almost a benign war in which we attack and destroy only military targets, and every bomb hits the target. Every bomb hits what we aim it at. At least that's the impression I get from these briefings, because I have yet to see them display a foot of film in which we've missed a target. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm an aviator, a military aviator who's dropped an awful lot of bombs in his day, and I want you to know that with any weapon, you will hit some targets and you will miss some targets. In a fairly recent briefing, General Schwarzkopf pointed out our campaign against the bridges, which are essential to the lines of communication leading to Kuwait. And he said we had attacked 33 of them with 790 sorties. And then he said, let's roll that tape. They proceeded to show a series of either three or four bombs, each one hitting a bridge directly, a direct crushing blow at the bridge. Mm-hmm. And then that was the end of that explanation of how the war was going. Well, I did some arithmetic. 790 attacks against 33 bridges figures out 24 attacks per bridge, and they weren't all down yet. If every bomb hits a target, why do we have to go back 24 times and more times even after that? The answer is that there are an awful lot of these weapons, smart and dumb bombs, that do not hit what they're aimed at or are aimed at the wrong target. And as a result, when they start showing us films in Riyadh of bombs missing target, I'll have a lot more confidence that we're seeing what war really looks like. We probably are only 10 to 20% into their combat capability at this stage, if that much. And believe me, it has been a very successful air campaign to date. It's just that the American public has expected too much of it because they've been coached by the White House to expect too much.
Admiral Eugene Carroll is my guest. He's the deputy director of the Center for Defense Information. What does it mean that the Republican Guard in Iraq is dug in? I know in Vietnam it was a literal term. The Viet Cong were in tunnels underground, but I wouldn't imagine that would be possible in the desert.
It's not possible to dig in to the depth that you could achieve in many places in Vietnam, but they still are well protected against anything except direct hits in their gun emplacements, in their tank shelters, in their personnel shelters. They are below the surface. They do have camouflage. They do have sand berms, as they're called, built up around them, so that unless you get a bomb or a missile directly into that enclosure, all you're going to do is throw a lot of sand around. You're certainly going to shake them up. It's not very pleasant living under those circumstances, but the units, equipment, and the people survive probably 19 out of every 20 bombs that are dropped on their positions because they don't hit directly on a prepared, dug-in position.
We've already had a few casualties and some disturbing pictures of POWs on TV, but by and large, up till now, it's still been a very high-tech war, a sort of a Nintendo-type war. Once the ground war starts, is that phase over, or are there high-tech weapons that can be brought to bear in a ground war?
Well, let's talk about that in two ways. First, this has not been a high-tech war. A lot of the technology that's being used out there was developed 20 years ago. My ship, the USS Midway, the aircraft carrier, was built 45 years ago. I scarcely class her as a high-tech weapon. But the fact is that it is the weight of our effort that is producing the results, not the superior technology alone. Let me give one measure of that. Secretary Cheney said that the Iraqis were the fourth major military power in the world because they had spent $50 billion on armaments in the last 10 years. In the last 10 years, the United States spent $2.6 trillion on armaments, or 50-plus times as much as the Iraqis. Who can doubt the outcome of a war between the United States of America and Iraq when we have 50 times the weight of preparation in dollars, at least? So that the fact is we're overwhelming them with bombs, with artillery, with naval forces, and it's only when we have to go in on the ground that you really recognize the fact that this is a classic war, that people shoot people with artillery pieces, with machine guns, with mines, and so on. And that's where the casualties are going to come. And you're right, the benign picture of this high-tech Nintendo contest that has been presented so often in these briefings is going to fade very rapidly. It will be a bloody, brutal war on the ground.
I've heard descriptions of some of the weapons that the Iraqis are likely to use as, like, gas-filled trenches that they could set on fire and tanks would explode and not be able to cross them, and barbed wire, and actually some of the lowest-tech sort of techniques that you can imagine. Is that your reading of what a ground war would be like?
In the initial phases, if we go directly against their major strongholds, the heavy defenses they've built up in and around Kuwait, yes, it would be fighting through a series of very cleverly designed obstacles that try to force the advancing units to approach through certain avenues, what are called killing zones, and their weapons will be concentrated on those lines that they think we must follow. It's for this reason that I'm willing to speculate, at least, that the major U.S. attack will come well west of Kuwait, will be to the west of those heavy defenses, and will drive northward, cutting off Kuwait, cutting off their supplies through the Euphrates River Valley, and sealing those troops in Kuwait so that if they want to fight, they have to come out to fight. When they come out of these prepared fortifications, these tank traps and minefields and so on, then they are vulnerable to our artillery, our aircraft, and the battle would be fought on much more favorable terms for us. If they don't come out, they simply run out of supplies, and I suspect we would be capable of producing a total military victory over Iraqi forces north of Kuwait in 4 to 8 weeks and force a political surrender as well as a military surrender.
Retired Admiral Eugene Carroll is the Deputy Director of the Center for Defense Information. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Pat Ford. Coming up, the environmental impact of the war. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Abdullah Toukan is the science advisor to the King of Jordan. Before the war started, he warned that a Gulf War could result in environmental catastrophe. Now he says those fears are turning to reality, but the worst may be yet to come. In a ground war, oil fields could be set on fire, leading to a chain reaction of fires, resulting in deadly chemicals being released into the air. Saddam Hussein is holding the environment hostage in this war. The U.S. military says he intentionally released oil into the Gulf from a Kuwaiti oil platform, creating the Gulf's largest and most devastating oil spill. Saddam Hussein is still threatening to set the oil fields of Kuwait on fire. I asked Dr. Toukan if he and other Middle East leaders were urging Saddam Hussein to not foul their own part of the world.
You know, Terry, we have, and they've heard us, obviously. But, let me tell you how the logic presents itself then when, let's say, the answers I got back, okay? For instance, one answer is that the United States used oil as a weapon first, which is, now here I'm relaying to you the logic of an argument that was given to me.
By whom, by the way?
Oh, by them and by people closely associated with them, with Iraq.
Oh, by Iraqis?
Yes.
Okay.
Is that the oil weapon was used, and the United States and their allies used it first against us. And I said, which way? They said by an oil embargo in the beginning, during August, September, before the war broke out. And then the second thing they said is that look at the refineries around Baghdad, they were destroyed. Most of the petrochemical industry in Iraq proper has been destroyed and has been bombed away. Then they said the first oil spill leak had started when they hit the two tankers. It wasn't us. So then the last thing they said if they use it, then we want to use it as a defense as well. We will use everything possible. And the only answer is to plead, because I'm not here. I told them I'm not really in the position as a scientist, and I'm not there really to sit down and point the finger at anybody who started what at the moment. The point is the damage has been done. How do we avert any more and stop any more from being done? Because this won't do us any good. Militaristically speaking, it has a very minimal effect, even if you spill water and spill oil in the waters of the Gulf. That was my, let's say, appeal. The rest, really, it's not in our hands. It's the logic that is being presented to you. So we've tried to appeal to the United Nations of through their resources, is to talk also and to talk to all sides concerned as to how we can do something. We've really tried, and I have presented my studies there, not personally, obviously, but sent the studies over and pleaded with them all the way.
When Iraqis come back at you with the argument that, you know, the United States was the first to use oil as a weapon, what's your counter-argument? How do you come back at them to defend the environment?
Well, you see, it's I come back to it in the whole part and parcel of everything, of saying that, my friends, I am not here to even talk to you about the reasons of invading Kuwait or not, or the whole world wanting to implement United Nations resolutions from 660 on. I am here just to plead with you that take what we have said into consideration and the vulnerabilities. And by the way, they have a very, very strong scientific infrastructure, incidentally. These people have very good petroleum engineers and scientific institutes in Iraq. So they're very well-educated scientists over there. And just conveyed our findings and pleaded with them that please take these into consideration. In addition to, we are always available here for anything we can do for innocent civilians that get in the way. There's no, you can't really transfer that into who did what or who blames who in this sense. You see, because once I do that, then you lose the whole core and the whole point of the scientific argument or the humanitarian component of this. Then we might as well then flow into surface-to-surface missiles. They tell me, really, this is the kind of conversation I got into. Well, look at the Tomahawk missiles. Who fired them first into Baghdad on January the 16th or 17th morning, whenever it was? They did. So we shot out. You know, when you start getting into this, and then you would say, well, you said you will do this. And they said, well, I would have, but if they didn't. So I couldn't really get into that conversation. All I wanted to say was, you should know all this. Your calculations should show you all this. Please think very carefully, and we will try to convey this to the West as well for them to think very carefully and everybody to be in standing by just in case there is an accident that happens between both of you, between two sides, so that we can bring in an international team and clean it up.
What kind of reports have you been hearing from people in different countries in the Middle East about the quality of the air and if that has been affected at all by the war so far?
Yeah, I've heard a few things in Iraq itself that there has been traces of nerve gas.
From the bombing of the nerve gas plants.
That's right, yes. You see, that's really so unfortunate. There are a number of things. If, as alleged by the United States, and the President of the United States has made a statement that the nuclear and the chemical capability of Iraq has been destroyed, we know Iraq has two research reactors, one less than 1 megawatt thermal and one 5 megawatt thermal. If the 5 megawatt thermal was hit and the core cracked or the core was destroyed, then there will be quite a bit of radiation in and around the facility because it's a very highly enriched uranium reactor and it's been operating for 22 years. So the core itself will be radioactive, so in addition to the fuel element. So if there has been a seepage from the reactor, and with the meteorological conditions now, and there is wind, it could carry the radionuclides further away from the site. Who will be affected? The people there, and you've got the agricultural area, and you've got livestock. And what you have to worry about is obviously two things, iodine-131 and the cesium-137. We have no traces. We don't know really. In Jordan, we have not had actual reports or counts or anybody to report to us what the concentration amount is. But this I'm telling you as a worst case if somebody tells me I have destroyed a reactor. The chemical plants, there is now controversy whether the milk plant that was bombed, was it a biological weapons facility that was producing anthrax or was it a milk plant? You know, the worst thing you could ever do is to bomb a biological plant with anthrax because that will just disperse all over the place, all over the region, stay in the air for a while, and produce epidemics. And you know that the anthrax is about an 80% lethality rate.
What would you like your role to be as a scientist and environmentalist during this war?
I would, my role, I would really like to put together an international environment crisis management team. And to start linking up with the specialists and the experts from outside such that we continue our studies regarding the Gulf or any air pollution studies, so that when all this is all over, we have focused enough attention so we can prioritize ourselves quickly and go and attack the problem quickly, not to wait until the whole thing is over and then try to scramble people in and try to make assessments from the very beginning, and that takes a long period of time, and with time we have more the disaster has increased and its effects has increased. That's one thing I would like to do, is put together an international environment crisis management team together, and also to continue this linkage with them, continue association with them, such that in the future, if there is any other crisis, the component of environment can be plugged into the very beginning of the decision-making process. Not, unfortunately, like now, 2 weeks before the decision was made for the war.
Dr. Abdullah Toukan is science advisor to King Hussein of Jordan. He spoke to us from his home in Amman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.